I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today, two interviews. Later in the hour, we talk with jazz vocalist Tierney Sutton. The five-time Grammy nominee has been described as a musician-singer who uses her voice like an instrument. First, presidential historian and Pulitzer Prize-winning author Doris Kearns Goodwin joins us on the phone. She'll be speaking at the Brewster Ladies Library on October 5th. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
So your latest book, which will be released on November 5th, is The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism. And this is about the history of the first decade of the progressive era, but also about the relationship between these two men, right?
Correct. I mean, you know, I think what happens is when you're trying to write about somebody like Theodore Roosevelt, about whom so much has been written, you need to find some sort of angle. And I became really interested in their long friendship and in their relationship to the members of the press, because that's where Theodore Roosevelt really excelled, by making them his friends and figuring out how to make a bully pulpit. And William Howard Taft, for all of his other really great strengths, that was the one missing link in his armor.
Right. Now, you told Publishers Weekly that you're very careful about whom you write because you have to, quote, live with this person for a long time.
Embarrassingly, it took 7 years. I mean, I realized I wrote the outline for what I wanted to do in 2006. So, but it's been great fun. I mean, the thing about being a presidential historian, as much as, you know, it might seem odd to spend your time with dead presidents, is that each time I go back to a different era, you're learning about a whole part of our history, about a whole cast of characters you knew nothing about before. So, you know, to go from LBJ to JFK and then JFK to FDR and then Abraham Lincoln and now to this era at the turn of the 20th century. And each time you feel like, you know, you could be in college and never learn as much as you have to learn when you're forced to think about it, to write about it. So I always choose people that I want to be with. And it turned out in this case as well.
Yeah. Now, an overview of the book, so the gap between rich and poor has never been wider. Legislative stalemate paralyzes the country. Corporations resist federal regulations. Spectacular mergers produce giant companies. The influence of money in politics deepens. Bombs explode in crowded streets. Small wars proliferate from our shores. A dizzying array of inventions speeds the pace of daily life. It sounds like we could be talking about today.
I know. You know, it's so strange. You start one of these books, and there's no way you're really tying it to the present. I mean, when I started writing about Lincoln and the team of rivals, you know, there was no way I would have ever anticipated that Barack Obama was going to become president, that he would eventually read Team of Rivals, that when he was asked, you know, would you really be willing to put somebody into your inner circle who was a chief rival, even if his or her spouse were an occasional pain in the butt, that he would say, Lincoln said, you know, the country's in peril. These are the strongest and most able people in the land. I will put these rivals into my cabinet. You know, and suddenly Team of Rivals became a word that people used. I mean, people said, do you think about that? When I started the book, I probably didn't even know who Barack Obama was.
Right, yeah.
So you don't start with that. Although I think what is true is that there are cycles in history, and certain periods do resemble other periods more than they would otherwise. You know, if you're in the middle of the 1950s, you know, the early 20th century or today would not seem as relevant in that placid time. But it does seem like there are lots of echoes now between our situation now and what happened at the turn of the century, because you had that Industrial Revolution, which changed the whole economics and the nature of the country. And we've had the Technological Revolution, which has done the same for us now.
And so lessons probably that we can learn from, you know, looking back at similar issues in the early 20th century, some lessons we can take away from that?
Well, I mean, my whole hope in being an historian is that if you look back at the leaders of the past and you see their strengths and weaknesses, their triumphs and their failures, that you have to be able to learn from them. Otherwise, you know, the notion is that we're just all on our own and there's nothing valuable about looking backward. And that's the whole point of doing history, really, in some ways, is not only to tell a story about a previous era, but to hope that people in the later time will see, you know, there are things we can learn from these leaders. What made them successful? What made them fail? And there's certain universal traits, I believe, of leadership that go through. Now that I've spent so much time with lots of my guys, whether it's FDR or Lincoln or Teddy Roosevelt now, and tap, you learn what it is that makes them successful. So, yes, you do hope that there are things we, the living, can learn from before us.
Yeah. Now, let's go back. Early in your career, you were a White House fellow in the Johnson administration, and you would eventually be assisting President Johnson in drafting his memoirs once he left office. Your first book was based on conversations you had with him. So tell us a little bit about your relationship with Lyndon Johnson.
Well, there's no question that the relationship with Lyndon Johnson was the root of my interest in presidential history. I mean, I've always loved history from the time I was a little girl. I mean, my father having taught me how to keep score at baseball games, so I could, the history of that afternoon's Brooklyn Dodger game probably, you know, instilled in me from the time I was six. There's something magic about history to tell a story to a father that you want to be listening to. And then I had teachers in high school who loved history. But without a question, that experience of working for LBJ, you know, when I was 24 years old, and having the chance to talk to this huge lion of a man and get a sense of what he was feeling and thinking during those last years of his life, directed me into this path of presidential history. And then once you write the first one, you feel you've learned maybe something about presidencies and histories. And my husband had been involved in Kennedy administration, so that seemed like a natural next step. And then I'd always been interested in World War II. So somehow they all sort of worked their way from one to the other.
Yeah. So how did your personal relationship with President Johnson impact how you wrote about him? And do you think you would have approached it differently, you know, now?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I mean, I think to some extent, because I saw him at the end of his life when he was so sad and so vulnerable, and probably talked to me in ways that he wouldn't have had I known him at the height of his power, it created a certain empathy toward him that made me want to understand the inner person behind the public figure rather than writing at a distance from my characters.
Right.
So I suspect it meant that from then on, I hadn't really thought about this, but I probably became emotionally involved, even though I never knew the rest of them, with all the people that I wrote about. And I think in some ways, it really helps. If you're going to spend that amount of time, you know, I could never write about Hitler or Stalin and spend my days with somebody I didn't fundamentally want to be with, even though they all, of course, have their flaws and their weaknesses. Mm-hmm. And without a question, you know, that chance to be so young and to have a president talking so openly and honestly about what he was feeling and thinking at a time when he was so sad in his life probably made everything else possible.
We mentioned a team of rivals, the political genius of Abraham Lincoln. That really ignited a whole renewed interest in President Lincoln. Of course, we had the movie Lincoln, which was based in part on your book. Did you anticipate the kind of response that followed the book and the movie?
No, I didn't, to be honest. You know, I mean, we were involved earlier because my husband wrote a book called Remembering America, which was about his experiences with the 1960s, because he worked for Kennedy and Johnson, was with Bobby when he died, and he'd had a chapter in it earlier about his investigation of the rigged television quiz shows. Mm-hmm. So Robert Redford made a wonderful movie about that called The Quiz Show, and in fact it was about my husband, so that was even more personal, obviously, than the movie about Lincoln. But what just happened, I think a combination of things happened. There was the anniversary of Lincoln's birth that happened. There's always been interest in Lincoln. I mean, there's not even a question when you have 14,000 books written about him that you will get an audience if you write about Lincoln. There are people out there, Lincoln clubs, Lincoln forums, and then just the idea that Steven Spielberg did such an extraordinary job and Daniel Day-Lewis inhabited the role of Lincoln.
Yeah.
It was really fun. I mean, much more than I could have imagined. They really made me part of the team. I went with them from place to place, went to Richmond when they were doing the filming, you know, was able to see every draft that Tony Kushner produced, and it was fun. Mm. It's another whole world.
Yeah.
And just to be a part of it was much more exhilarating than I could have imagined.
Yeah, and you got to be much more part than I think a lot of authors. I mean, that's the, you know, when your book is made into a film, it isn't always a rewarding experience, and Hollywood often doesn't do the book justice. But in this case, it sounds like you're saying it sure did.
Oh, without a question. Yeah, I remember there was some famous saying, I think maybe it was Scott Fitzgerald, I can't remember who it was, she said, you should just drop your book across the line in California and then go away. You don't know what they're going to do with it.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, but we were really lucky, as I say, because we had Redford for my husband's movie and then Spielberg for this. And he's a real mensch of a guy. I mean, he's just a wonderful person. So And he is a team player, so he wanted people. You felt like you were part of a group of people. And that's the magic in a certain sense. You know, as a writer, you're writing alone. You're not really traveling with a group of people anywhere. And from the time they started making this movie many, many years ago, it was just another dimension of what I was doing to have this circle of friends that became the movie group.
Yeah, and you're right. Daniel Day-Lewis, Sally Field. I mean, the cast just was phenomenal. They did such a great job. I have to say, especially Daniel Day-Lewis. You really believe, he was so believable.
He became Lincoln. There's no question. When he first was chosen as Abraham Lincoln, Steven Spielberg asked me if I would go with him to Springfield, Illinois, to show him the sites of Lincoln's home and his law offices and the State House. So we spent a couple days together, and he hadn't even yet been announced as playing Abraham Lincoln. And I could tell then, you know, he just was ready to start reading everything he could. He spent a year reading about Lincoln, thinking about him. You know, once he learned that he walked as if he were a laborer coming home from a hard day, you saw that walk on the screen. When he learned that he had a high-pitched voice, you know, people said, I thought he would have spoken in a deeper way. That was the way Lincoln spoke. And the film played such an important part of getting every detail right. I remember when I went down to the place where they had recreated the White House. It was some miles from Richmond where the film was being shot. And they said to me, wait till you see this room. And I went to this old pinball factory that had been converted into a place for them to build sets and costumes. And it seemed interesting, but not incredible. And then they said, no, no, you haven't seen anything. And they opened a door, and inside was the reconstruction of the White House in the 1860s. I was just blown away. Mm-hmm. I mean, the rug was as it looked then. They'd gotten the wallpaper that looked like the wallpaper that they had from a picture at the time. The books on the shelf were books Lincoln had been reading.
Wow.
So that's really important for the characters to feel that they've been catapulted back to an earlier era.
Yeah, for sure. Well, as you mentioned, you write about significant historical figures. So what are some of the challenges of writing about people when so much has been written about them already?
It's huge. I mean, the benefit of writing about these people, which is why so many people write about them, is because they tend to be the most interesting of our presidents. They lived in dramatic eras, so you know that you're going to have a fascinating set of characters to write about. But on the other hand, as you exactly say, so many people have written about them. Sometimes I dream of finding some obscure person nobody's ever written about, and maybe I'll finish the book in a year instead of 7 years. Then the challenge is you have to try and come up with some different angle, you know, which is why I wrote about the home front during World War II and Franklin and Eleanor's partnership instead of a straight biography about either FDR or Eleanor, why I wrote about Lincoln's cabinet, and now this time about the relationship with Teddy and Taft and the journalists, because otherwise, I mean, you could write the same biography and hopefully in a different way give some penetrating look into it, but I never feel comfortable unless I have my own story to tell somehow.
Right. Yeah. So your books are often praised for compelling narratives. Does that come naturally to you as a writer, or do you find it a struggle to weave the history and biography into a narrative arc?
Well, I think, you know, in some ways, what matters to me more than anything is telling a story. You know, when I think about what my talent is, you know, perhaps even more than, you know, writing sentences. I mean, I'd love to be a poet and know that these sentences were beautiful. But what I think I've always been able to do, mostly as a talker rather than even a writer, from the time I've been little, is to love to tell stories. And I think history at its best in some ways is telling stories of these people who lived before. So, I mean, you're right. That's the most important thing to me in the structure of these books, is how to tell a story from beginning to middle to end. I remember reading an essay by my heroine, Barbara Tuchman, fantastic writer who read Her Guns of August when I was still in college, and here was a female historian writing about battles and World War One. But more importantly, she later said, if you're writing about a war as a narrative historian, you have to imagine to yourself you do not know how that war ended, so you can carry your reader with you every step along the way from beginning to middle to end, so that you only know what the people who lived at the time knew. You know, and I think somewhat when you're in an academic world, I know when I was first teaching, it's almost the opposite. You're trying to make points, and you're trying to think about what other scholars have said, and you might flip ahead to the future to make a point about the past. And I think that the challenge of narrative history is to just tell the story as people experienced it at the time.
So you have written a memoir, Wait Till Next Year. I think it was 1997 that came out. Can you describe that process of writing that book, and if writing about your own recollections in life has influenced how you view the source material that you use for other books?
Well, it was so different. I mean, I never would have done it, I think, except for the fact that when I was out talking about Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt, which came out in 1994, the documentary that Ken Burns did on the history of baseball came out at the same time, and he had previously interviewed me because a lot of the documentary was going to be about the two teams that were my beloved teams, the Brooklyn Dodgers and the Boston Red Sox. So I was on air a lot more than I realized I would have been, and people kept saying, why don't you write about your love of baseball? I mean, I don't think I would have thought, why would I write a memoir? And it turned out to mean a lot more than I would have thought. It was really different because it meant interviewing people, going back to find my old friends, going back to my own town, reading to some extent newspapers from that time, but not the search through primary sources that so involves me today, letters and diaries and old newspapers. It was more of a journalist's challenge in a certain sense than an historian's challenge. And yet by reconnecting to those old friends and, you know, remembering my parents who died so long ago, it meant much more than I thought. And it also took only a year. It took me longer to write about World War II than the war itself, 10 years about Civil War, and now 7 about this. So that was an enormous treat.
Here's a little tidbit I bet people may not know about you. First woman journalist to enter the Red Sox locker room.
Right. What happened, I used to go down to spring training so I could write some feature piece so I could take my kids to spring training and probably, to be honest, take myself to spring training. And so it just happened I was down there at the Red Sox spring training camp when the ruling came down from Major League Baseball saying that women had to be allowed in the locker room. So the owner of the Red Sox said, go in.
Yeah.
So it's a Trivial Pursuit question.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, England.
Now we'll know that answer.
In the locker room.
So I want to talk just a little bit more about your research, as you're mentioning, 7 years for your latest book. And part of that is because you are delving into all of this archival stuff, letters and things. When is enough? Because when you think about these, you know, look at Abraham Lincoln, the things that have been written. I mean, you must drive yourself crazy going through all of this material. You can't possibly go through everything.
No,
how do you do that?
I mean, I think, you know, the key is, and again, I remember some historian, maybe it was Barbara Tucker or maybe somebody else who said, the key thing is you can't just do all your research and then decide to start writing or you'll paralyze yourself. Mm. So I always write chronologically. So as long as I get started, if I start doing the research and I'm telling a story that begins, say, with World War II in 1940, I mean, I'm only covering 1940 to 45, so the first year or two, I might have already done the research for 1940 and written those chapters and then moved on. I mean, you sort of read background before you even start, so you know the whole story itself. But otherwise, it is true. You could never stop.
Yeah.
And at a certain point, you just have to say, this is it for now, or else you'd be writing one book. And even so, I mean, unlike so many other people, I haven't written that many books over my lifetime, but it does take me so long.
Yeah, it takes you long. And, you know, it makes sense that, you know, how you came across to write the book on President Johnson makes sense. And then, of course, your husband was in the Kennedy administration. But then you get to Lincoln, FDR, some of these other figures. Did you find things along the way in your research for your first couple of books that led you in those directions? And just thinking like your newest book that's coming out, what was it? You know, when did you decide that this story of the relationship between these two men was compelling enough to be your next book?
No, that's a really good question. I think what it is that relationships is the key word. I mean, what interests me most are the human dimensions of these characters, you know, whether it's their relationships with their wives or their friends, or in this case, these two presidents who had a long friendship before it ruptured. And even in Team of Rivals, I mean, I was really talking about Lincoln's relationship with these people inside his cabinet, not just in a formal way, but they had all kept letters and wrote diaries describing daily life with Abraham Lincoln. Mm. With Franklin and Eleanor, their partnership became the central key of the book, as well as that small circle within the White House, all of whom lived there, Harry Hopkins and his secretary, Missy LaHand, and the princess from Norway, and Winston Churchill. And I just find in relationships, the key to understanding leadership and really the personalities of the people you're trying to make come alive.
Mm. So you discover some little like letters or some tidbit that you go, ah, there may be a story here. And that's what sort of what sends you off in that direction?
I mean, I think letters and diaries are the treasures. When I look back, I have a really hard time writing about a modern president. Mm. I mean, there'd be so much more stuff to write about. Perhaps President Obama right now, we'd have moving pictures that show how he walked, how he talked, unlike what we don't have about Lincoln or Teddy Roosevelt to some extent. But what we wouldn't have 200 years from now are people writing handwritten letters at the end of the day or keeping a diary in the end of the afternoon so that you get that intimate sense. So I think I always need to go backward in time when those resources are available to give you as if you're looking over the shoulder of somebody who is writing that letter or keeping that diary entry.
Yeah. And so as you say, you know, it takes 7 years for this book, a long time for you to put your books together. Do you take sort of a break between? I mean, are you planning, you'll have a book tour coming up, but then do you take some time off or are you going to delve right into your next topic?
I don't know. You know, I mean, I'm really just finishing.
Yeah.
So it's really, I feel like I'm in high school again. But I just finished
deadline.
At the time when it had to be finished. And so it's a pretty great feeling right now to know that I finally met the deadline. And I'm sure I will start sometime soon trying to think of what to do next. I mean, if this is what you love to do, I'm certainly not going to not find some other subject in these next years ahead.
Right. New book is The Bully Pulpit, Theodore Roosevelt, William Howard Taft, and the Golden Age of Journalism, coming out November 5th. Historian and Pulitzer Prize-winning author Doris Kearns Goodwin will be visiting the Brewster Ladies Library on October 5th. Doris, thanks so much for taking time to talk
You're
with us.
You're so welcome. Thank you.
Coming up after the break, we visit with jazz vocalist Tierney Sutton.
This is WCAI. We have updated information on historian and author Doris Kearns Goodwin's appearance on Saturday. It takes place at the Brewster Baptist Church. The event is sold out.
Jeff Morris, former curator of the Pilgrim Monument Museum.
President William Taft came to Provincetown on August 5th, 1910, to dedicate the Pilgrim Monument. Of course, he's a fairly large man. I think he's over 300 pounds. He's the largest president we've ever had. After the dedication of the monument, they had a banquet at Town Hall, and at Town Hall they had a menu of hors d'oeuvres of iced olives and pickles and lobster stew. Then they had salmon cutlets and peas, sliced cucumbers and tomatoes, crackers, cold roast tenderloin, smoked tongue, roasted turkeys, chicken thinly sliced ham, potato salad, chestnut stuffing. But then you had dessert puddings and ice cream and different sherbets and coffee. That was the banquet. I don't know if he ate all of this himself, but definitely they were prepared for an appetite.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.
This week in This American Life, a man is recruited by government intelligence. His job? To test the security of banks by trying to rob them. And his handler tells him,
do not stay in a bank for longer than 5 minutes. And if you get arrested, stay silent. We'll have you out within 24 hours.
So, he gets arrested. And then, he learns his handler doesn't actually work for the government. This week.
Join us for This American Life, Saturday at noon and Sunday evening at 6, here on WCAI, the Cape and Islands NPR station.
Vocalist Tierney Sutton is a 5-time Grammy nominee and is described as a musician singer who uses her voice like an instrument. She's fronted the Tierney Sutton Band for over 20 years. They will be performing at Falmouth's Jazz Festival on October 5th. Tierney has been Jazz Week's Vocalist of the Year, received the LA Jazz Society's Vocalist Award, and has been at the top of critics and listeners' polls. In addition to her work with the Tierney Sutton Band, she performs in an intimate trio format with jazz flute legend Herbert Laws and guitar virtuoso Larry Coons, and she's also begun a collaboration with the award-winning Turtle Island Quartet. As an active educator, she taught for over a decade at USC's Thornton School of Music. She's currently the vocal department head at the Los Angeles Music Academy in Pasadena, where she's created a curriculum for vocalists. She joins us on the telephone this morning. Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Now, you have a degree in Russian language and literature. So how did you find your way to singing in jazz?
Well, you know, I was in school and studying Russian, and I got a summer job as a waitress I had always sung, but I hadn't found any work that were music that really struck me. And there was a jazz trio across the street that I heard, and I said, "Oh wow, this is it!" And I was actually a singing waitress, and we were doing music that was pretty god awful, pretty sure. And when I heard jazz, when I heard this wonderful trio, I realized that the songs I liked best in our show were standards that we were slaughtering.
Yeah.
And from then, I went back to school, but had such a love for jazz and started learning more and more songs and working as a jazz singer in my college town at Wesleyan in Connecticut.
Yeah, and you also went to Berklee College of Music in Boston, right?
Yes, I did.
Yeah.
Yes, only very briefly, but I was there for a year or so.
Right. Let's talk about the band members, because this isn't your typical band in that you're the singer with a backup band. These band members are pretty amazing musicians in their own right. And I think that's part of the magic of the band, is you all have this great respect for each other and everybody's the star.
Yeah, no, it's a great band. The pianist is the wonderful Christian Jacob, who has just done a solo recording project, the solo piano record that'll be coming out that you should look for. The bassist is Kevin Axe, who's all over the place, and he does a million records every year with everybody. The drummer for this tour is going to be Ralph Humphrey, who is actually the drummer on Dancing with the Stars.
Oh, isn't that funny?
And so people can look for him on their TV. Unbelievable drummer. He was with Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention, Don Ellis, lots of amazing music this guy has played. And he also is the mentor of so many young drummers.
Yeah. So, as I mentioned, you guys have been playing together for over 20 years. That's a tough thing, you know. It's like a family, and, you know, you're touring. And what is the secret, do you think, to you guys being so cohesive and remaining, you know, friends and on friendly terms all these years?
Well, you know, I think we let each other. We've always understood that we are committed to this project, but we also have other things that we do. For all of us, mm-hmm. And we try to be as understanding about that as possible. You know, I just released a new album of Joni Mitchell music,
right,
with basically an entirely new cast of characters, and the band's been really supportive of that, as I am of their different projects that they all do.
Yeah. We are going to talk about that album, but before we get to that, I want to talk with this. The band is known for its imaginative arrangements of standards and your skill in using your voice to sound like an instrument. Let's hear an example of that.
Green, for purple. God shed his grace on thee and crown thy good with brotherhood from sea to shining sea.
Tierney, talk about the arrangements and how you do this magic that you do.
Well, you know, the arrangements come about all different ways. Sometimes one person brings in an idea that might be a little sketch, and the rest of us consult about it and alter that sketch. Sometimes two of us are playing with an idea at a sound check, or two of us are talking about something on the road.
Mm-hmm.
Often I settle on a song that I'm interested in doing, but also often the drummer and bassist will be playing a groove, and I'll say, keep playing that, and I'll start singing over it.
Right.
In the case of America, that was an unusual one, because what happened with that is Christian had done a reharmonization for his trio. And I fell so in love with that reharmonization that I couldn't really imagine a more beautiful version of America the Beautiful than the chord structure that he came up with.
Yeah.
And so I decided to do it wordlessly mm-hmm. at first, and then with the modulation into the words.
Yeah. Now let's talk about the new album, After Blue, which, as you mentioned, is a collection of Joni Mitchell tunes reimagined. So obviously you're a big fan of Joni Mitchell.
Yes, I am. But the strange thing was that, you know, I knew Joni's work a little bit, just a little bit. Only like a superficial pop fan would know it as a young person. I wasn't a teenage Joni Mitchell fan. But all of my friends are and were. And so in these years, when in my teen years, I sort of became a jazz nun, and all I listened to was jazz. So I knew Joni had done a cover of, I knew she had done a cover of Twisted. I knew she'd done Goodbye Pork Pie Hat.
Mm-hmm.
But so I knew a little of the Mingus album, but I didn't really know her work at all.
Yeah. Well, you read in the liner notes, I knew that Mitchell's music was not something I could glance at and then perform. I had to live with it for years, like her fans who absorbed the music in their youth. I wanted to marinate in Joni Mitchell.
Yeah. And I kind of did for about a good solid 10 years. And but it is, it's tricky because, of course, people are so passionate, you know, about her. And I didn't want to do something superficial. So in the, before this period, and even during this period, a lot of my closest friends and also musical advisors were like, "Wow, you should think about Joni Mitchell. You should do some Joni Mitchell." and I thought to myself, "You don't just do some Joni Mitchell,
right?
You know,
yeah.
So
yeah, but especially with that, you know, that voice and yeah, as you say, sort of. So her these versions, as we met, kind of reimagined. They're not exactly the way Joni did them. Let's hear a clip of Taxi.
They paved paradise, put up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Oh, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Ooh, bop, bop, ba-da-da-do. Took all the trees, put them in a tree museum. And they charged the people a dollar and a half just to see them. Oh, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Ooh, bop, bop, ba-da-da-doo. Give me spots on my apples, but give me the birds and the bees, please. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Ooh, up, up, ba-da-da-doo. Up, up, ba-da-da-doo. Night I heard the screen door slam, and a big yellow taxi took away my old man. Oh, don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot. Ooh, up, up, ba-da-da-doo. Up, up, ba-da-da-doo.
Has Joni Mitchell commented on the album?
No, I don't
know what she
thinks. I know a lot of people that know her, and she lives here in L.A., and I would imagine she'll probably get wind of it, but I don't know. I know she's busy and got her own stuff going on.
It's really unique what you've done with her music. It's Joni Mitchell, but it's Joni Mitchell with your take, I guess. And I don't know if you did this all yourself, the arrangements, but very interesting arrangements that you've come up with for these tunes.
Well, you know, that one was actually, that's actually Ralph Humphrey, who will be with me in Falmouth. And we had been doing it on the road a little bit. And for many years, I've enjoyed singing duos with the drummer. I always like to do that. It's just a really fun thing to do. And so Ralph and I talked about doing something in an odd time signature in five, and that song just sat really well in five. So that was really a spontaneous thing, and so I just had him come in the studio, and we bopped it down. Mm. So
That was my favorite on the album, by the way. I thought that was, I mean, they're all great, but that was my favorite.
Thank you. I'll tell Ralph that some of these are not really arranged at all. In that, the duos like the duos with Larry Goldings on piano. We had only, I had only sung with him one other time.
Wow.
We went into the studio. He came over to my house. We talked about the Joni Mitchell stuff. We talked about the songs we might like to do in the keys. We spent about 45 minutes at the piano. That's it.
Wow.
And then the next time I laid eyes on him pretty much was in the studio, and we did takes, and they were first or second takes, and that was that.
Wow, that's amazing to be able to do that. Yeah.
So we knew that there was kind of a magic of the moment and a understanding between us of what we wanted to do.
Yeah. That's great when it works like that, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. And I think that's the gift of being old, frankly. You know, I mean, when you're 20, you may have a certain magic of improvisational guts. But when you're 50 and you've really absorbed some music, when I asked Larry, I knew he was the guy, and I knew that he would be able to just sit down and do it without being told what to do. And that was sure true.
You mentioned, you know, kind of living with Joni's music for a while and really absorbing, as you say, marinating in Joni Mitchell. But for the rest of me, where do you find your inspiration?
Wow. Where do I find my inspiration? Well, I mean, I'm a pretty spiritual person, or at least I attempt to be on my better days. Mm-hmm. I'm a Baha'i, and I have a practice of prayer and meditation, and music and my work is part of that practice for sure. And the consultation that goes on between musicians is very much part of that practice. Mm-hmm. So a lot of my inspiration comes from these great musicians that I get to work with, and being able to jump off of their sensibility, you know, their experience, their, you know, amazing gift. Mm-hmm. That's a big part. And in this album, it's definitely the case, whether it's Al Jarreau or Hubert Laws or Larry Goldings on piano or organ, mm-hmm. you know, and it's been the same with my band for 20 years.
Yeah.
I'm down to stalking the slot that's hot. I keep hearing bells all around me, jingling the lucky jackpots. They keep you tantalized, they keep you reaching for your wallet here in fool's paradise. I talked to a cat from Des Moines. He said he ran a cleaning plant. That cat was clanking Bitcoin. Well, he must have had a genie lamp, cause every time I dropped a dime, I blew it. He kept ringing bells, nothing to it. He thought they were just three lemons, three cherries, three plums. I'm losing my taste for fruit, watching the dry cleaner do it, like Midas in a polyester suit. It's all luck, it's just luck. You get a little lucky and you make a little money. Couldn't lose there. Ooh,
chips, raking off the tables, ringing the bandits' bells. This is a story that's a drag to tell in some ways, because I lost every dime I laid on the line. But the cleaner from Des Moines.
As we mentioned, you're also the vocal department head at the Los Angeles Music Academy in Pasadena. With your touring schedule, and we mentioned all these different artists that you're working with, how do you find time to teach?
Well, you know, it really depends. I have seasons where I'm touring a lot, and then I have periods where I'm not. I've been off the road for the last couple of months, and I just went to 6 student concerts in the last 48 hours.
Oh, fun.
And have been at school a whole bunch. So it really depends, you know. I also truly get a lot of inspiration from my students. Mm. And that's one of the reasons that I keep doing it, no matter how busy I get.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'll be on the road and I'll think, I can't go back and teach. Oh, I'm just too tired. And then I go in, and the amount of information and inspiration I get from the students, and it's not a jazz program, it's a vocal program.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're doing all sorts of different things. But what they'll do with a standard or the music that they bring in that they like, and the challenges that they take on, it's really incredible to watch them grow.
Yeah, I bet that's fun too, to go to the student concerts and see, you know, when they first walk into your classroom, and then as you say, as they grow, that's going to be a very rewarding experience.
It truly, truly is. And I'll tell you, you know, and it is like a mom. The ones that do the work, wow, what happens with them is just stunning.
So the concert is Saturday, October 5th, 7:30 p.m. at Highfield Theater. Tickets are $30, can be purchased at jazzfestfalmouth.org or at 8 Cousins on Main Street in Falmouth. We're going to go out with On Broadway, which won a Grammy nomination in 2012. Tell us a little bit about this tune before we hear it.
All right, well, this, before the Joni Mitchell stuff, this was the first thing that the band had ever arranged that was written after 1950, you know? So it's a really classic tune, and it's a great example of the band's arranging technique, because we all had serious input in this arrangement. There was not one arranger on this, for sure. So the nomination for all of us was very much justified.
Tierney Sutton, thanks so much for taking time to talk with us today. We look forward to seeing you on October 5th.
Thank you.
They say the neon lights are bright on Broadway. They say there's always magic in the air. But when you're walking down the street and you ain't had enough to eat, the glitter rubs right off and you're nowhere. You're nowhere. Nowhere. They say the men all treat you fine on Broadway, but looking at them just gives me the blues. How you're gonna make some time when all you got is one thin dime? And one thin dime won't even shine your shoes. That I won't last too long on Broadway. I'll catch a Greyhound bus for home. They all say, but they're dead wrong. I know they are, 'cause I can play this here guitar, and I won't quit till I'm a star on Broadway.
I won't quit till I'm a star on Broadway.
Tierney Sutton. The Tierney Sutton Band will be performing during Jazz Fest Falmouth this Saturday evening at Highfield Theater in Falmouth. A Jazz Fest schedule and information online at jazzfestfalmouth.org.